and there was loads on the radio to catch your ear, from the situation in Gaza and those heartbreaking stories of the menopause to hitchhiking in the COVID era. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I believe the actions of the Israeli government are indefensible. Annexation, expulsion, plantation, the killing of civilians deliberately or in terms of collateral damage is not the behaviour of a democratic state in the 21st century.
The last time actually I hitchhiked was for Ryan Tuberty, did it on the radio, and I hitched from Bantry to Bundoran to see could I get there before the bus, and I did.
And I'm glad I retired, having to find the toilet, having to carry pads on a uniform that you have no extra pocket, having to explain to a partner sometimes, oh, I got to pop into the bathroom here. What's wrong with you? Why are you always going to the bathroom?
So let's start here. If you've got a little trepidation about getting back out and about, have a listen to Brian's email to Ryan in the morning.
A guy calls himself Brian, emails in, he says, I think he seems to be having lockdown nostalgia already. How can anyone? I mean, we're not even allowed to have a pint with friends outside in the pub. You know, I mean, we can have the plastic cups and stuff, but we haven't got to the 7th of June. Not that it's etched in my brain or anything. We haven't got there yet, or hotels or anything. But anyway, he says, look, I was fortunate enough to get my COVID vaccine on Wednesday afternoon, but you don't look an age, a day over 70. The waiting area was full of smiling faces, he says, and there was a great sense of anticipation in the air. However, once I got home and started to feel that the end of COVID was near, I experienced what can only be described as an existential crisis. My mind tells me that we are going from the known COVID world, which is not at all desirable, to an unknown post-COVID world. Getting into the whole Rumsfeld world here. But anyway, will things return to what they were previously? Asks Brian. Were things really that great? Going out, meeting and hugging friends will be exciting, but what about all the other stuff? The stuff we didn't have to deal with, like career plans and traffic and shopping centres and making decisions and people. What about that? For the past 14 months, we haven't had to deal with much of that. My recollection of the start of the pandemic was the sense that people were stopping and thinking about their lives and their priorities. Did we do that? Now the same reassessment is going to have to take place and it'll all be a challenge. I think I'm supposed to have learned something from all this, but I don't think I have. Am I a worrier? Do I have Stockholm syndrome? Am I the only one? So many questions, so little time. But is that a table for one in terms of anxiety and worry, wondering what next? I think it might be a bit too soon to ask what next. I think we're still in it. Not enough people vaccinated, not enough freedom of movement for my liking. So I think it's a bit previous. But I think you're completely right to wonder. Not worry, though. I wouldn't worry about it. I think it is a bit of Stockholm syndrome. And we have to have learned something. Or this awful expression people say, what are the learnings? The learnings? Huh? Anyway, we have to just roll with the language. It's driving me mad. So what do you do with it? We just have to take the best bits, cherry pick the best bits that we've learned from it, if anything. But no, don't fall in love with lockdown. No. It wasn't good. It wasn't good. Don't. It's like Goodbye Lenin, isn't it? Where you fall in love with the darkness. Anyway, thank you for that lovely email. And it was interesting. Very interesting thoughts on it all.
And Vivian was listening to Brian's email and he got in contact too.
I think I have time to read this from Vivian Guerin, former director of the Irish Probation Service. On the subject of Brian's email regarding the prospects of progressing out of COVID restrictions, he says, this reminds me of what many people feel serving prison sentences. They call it gate fever as they get nearer to their release date. And it's a feeling of positive excitement about the prospect of getting out of jail combined with an underlying fear of how they will cope and if they will cope, as well as, believe it or not, fear of the loss of the familiar, what they have become used to in custody. This is the result of the process of institutionalisation. No matter what our current or ongoing situation, the prospect of change, even to a better future, can cause anxiety. All change involves loss, and loss involves pain. And we can all become institutionalised in one way or another and need help, and most of all, understanding in how we navigate the changes. Brilliant comment from Vivian, who's the former director of the Irish Probation Service, because somebody was saying that it's like we've been in a class of prison. And that's not flippant thing to say. I actually think that's completely true. I also think there's a national trauma that needs to be addressed. And some people will like trauma and panic and nervousness. Some will be affected more than others. And it's worth having a conversation about, as we like to say. So let's keep that going.
From the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on the news at one, the situation in Gaza. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar was commenting on the actions of the Israeli government in the Doyle.
And I think all of us abhor Hamas and what's done in terms of terror and the violation of human rights of women and LGBT groups in particular. And none of us in any way would like any of our comments to be construed as support for Hamas in any way. And I'm sure the deputy in his further remarks will agree with that. But I think, like everyone in this house, I believe the actions of the Israeli government are indefensible. Annexation, expulsion, plantation, the killing of civilians deliberately or in terms of collateral damage is not the behaviour of a democratic state in the 21st century. And it's simply unacceptable that a state that is a democracy or any state should behave in this way.
And Brian Dobson also spoke to Lynn Hastings.
Lynn Hastings is Deputy Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process with the UN Office for Humanitarian Affairs based in Jerusalem. I asked her first about the significance of those reports of troops massing on the border with Gaza.
Yeah, yes, we've heard those reports as well. Of course, we don't know how accurate they are and for what purpose they would be used. The speculation by some, as you've just said, would be some sort of ground force. But, you know, I think military people would say there are a number of different reasons for those types of movements. Obviously, the UN wants a de-escalation in any event. And we would be concerned about any additional troops being sent, but also just a continuation of what's going on now.
So, I mean, we're hearing, for example, from Benjamin Netanyahu that they will continue to strike at the military capabilities of Hamas.
Yes, and we've been hearing the same thing, and that's definitely their public position. Again, sometimes the public isn't really privy to those sorts of things. All of the international community is calling for a de-escalation, for a cessation of these hostilities. And we are hoping that the Israelis and Hamas will adhere to those calls in the, you know, as soon as possible.
But what could persuade them to step back now at this stage for the Israelis to halt their operations and for Hamas to stop firing rockets into Israel?
Well, of course, that's the main question. There are a number of diplomatic efforts ongoing exploring exactly that type of question and what the solution to that could be. A lot of closed doors discussions going on, Security Council meetings and briefings. There's an American envoy who's landing this evening, discussions amongst the members of the quartet, and of course, most importantly, with the parties themselves.
And what about the intercommunal violence that we've seen within Israel, involving clashes between Jewish Israelis and Arab mm-hmm. Israelis? I mean, how worrying, how concerning is that?
It is a new development, which, of course, can always be worrying. We're not exactly sure where it is going. But I do think that not only the international community is worried, but I would assume that, again, those more regionally are concerned about that type of violence, which may have the potential actually to spill over more regionally as well. So, yes, we're watching that very closely.
What about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, so far as it's possible to establish what's going on there? We know that there have been innocent victims, child victims of the attacks. The Israeli ambassador told this program yesterday that they usually know who is killed in these Israeli attacks, but they also accept that there can be innocent victims. You know, what's facing the ordinary people of Gaza at the moment?
Yeah. Well, on Monday was really the date of the main escalation, where Hamas began launching rockets, and they've launched over 1,200 rockets, killing 7 Israelis with 200 injuries at least, and 12 of those injuries being quite serious. And of course, the other side of that is that there have been 67 Palestinians killed, including 17 children and 388 Palestinian injured. And what we're quite concerned about right now is the fact that fuel, which is supplied by Israel, is no longer going in, and Gaza will run out of fuel on Sunday, which of course is needed to run hospitals, which in this case, both in the midst of a pandemic and also having to respond to people who have been injured in these hostilities, but also access to water and to sanitation facilities, all of which require electricity. The Gazans have reduced their electricity usage by 50% to extend the reserve until Sunday, but as of Sunday, we'll run out. So
Lynn Hastings on the News at One with Brian Dobson. OK, so Toby from the West Wing, Selina Myers from Veep and Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It. Claire Byrne was talking about politics on screen in the company of journalist Lise Hand and Car Communications' Johnny Fallon. Claire was excited.
We rub our hands with glee. This is going to be great. Lise, we're going to start by looking at some of the series out there. You're going to start with the most famous political series of them all, The West Wing. That one works for you. You love it.
Yes, always have. And I actually know several people that during the last year went back and watched the box set as a kind of warm, fuzzy escapism. And, you know, it's the ultimate, I suppose it's the ultimate political series because it was so idealistic. It had this, you know, fantastically caring, you know, sort of, you know, figure in the White House and a marvellous ensemble cast, you know, whizzy dialogue, really interesting stories. And it was just when it first landed on our screens in 1999, you know, everybody just fell in love with it. Mm. Anybody, all political geeks did.
Did you go back and watch it again recently, in recent times?
I actually went back and watched the last series. Now, everybody talks about series 1 to 4. They were the ones that were written by Aaron Sorkin, and they are highly praised and rightly so, and won lots of Emmys because of their dialogue, plotting and script. But in advance of the last year's American election, I went back and watched the last series, series 7, and I actually thought it stood up very well. It did capture the excitement and the madness and the chaos of an election campaign. And I think that secretly a lot of political wonks sort of identified with the different characters. I'd say a lot of political wonks, you know, sort of centre-right guys or sort of centre-left. Oh, everybody wanted to be Josh Lyman, you know, that sort of thing. So, it paved the way for an awful lot of the political series that came after.
And then, like the ones that came after it, we have Veep.
Yes, we did. We had Veep, which again, I absolutely loved. Of course, it had a strong female lead, and that's what I loved as well. And there was a couple of others that had strong female leads, and I loved them for that. And, you know, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who played Selina Mayer. It was brilliant because it was profane and brash and malicious and full of self-serving characters and mm-hmm. you know, yes, people just waiting to stab the main character in the back. Brilliant dialogue, but I loved it before the fact that they just had a really strong female lead and lots of other really strong characters as well, and I think it was a very good reflection of the workings of politics, that the fact that you can have a politician who's all smiles on the outside closes the door and this turns into a complete and utter monster.
Yeah, I think the best of the whole lot of them, though, Johnny, and you might come in on this one, is The Thick of It. I just loved the irreverence of it. You know, when it aired first, I think we were all shocked, weren't we, that this was on the telly?
Yeah, I think it was one of those series where, you know, just the language, the approach, everything that it was saying, I think people were like, oh, my God, you know. But it gave that real insight into a different level of politics, different style of it. Again, like others, it's probably responsible, unfortunately, for a generation of advisors, I think particularly in the UK, who think that politics is like that all the time, you know, whereas in reality it's used a lot more sparingly. But it did cast a light, I think, on maybe in an extreme way, but on what it is like when sometimes the temperature gets turned up, and that backroom side of needing someone who actually calls a spade and actually says what they mean all the time.
I nearly forgot that it gave us some new words. One of them is omni-shambles. That's fine to say on the radio. The other one we're not allowed to, but it starts with cluster. That was a great one.
Yeah, I think it was. I think the main character, Nicola Murray, described Malcolm Tucker as the PM's all swearing eye, which I thought was a great description.
And who would have known that Leith Hand had a hand in some great Irish films?
All right, Lise, our next pick is a movie, and we're going back in time now to Michael Collins. And you think this is worth checking out, but you're also involved in how this came to be.
Well, I was actually involved. It was actually in the name of the father I was involved in, which, again, is, you know, going back into the past. And yeah, it was one of those things. The name of the father was directed by Jim Sheridan, and I gave him the original book to read, Proved Innocent, which is written by...
Were you friends with Jim Sheridan?
Friends with Jim Sheridan. And I gave him Proved Innocent, which is the book that Jerry Conlon wrote on his release. And Jim took a real shine to it, and both the film rights were actually owned by Gabriel Byrne at the time. So he negotiated. Gabriel Byrne came on board as an executive producer, and Jim brought me in initially with the usual chaotic carry-on that Jim loves. I was brought in as a researcher when they were himself and Terry Georgia writing the script, and that was absolutely fascinating. And then I kind of became a bit of a sort of general factotum on the set, and ended up also casting extras for some of the big scenes. And I mean, it was absolutely fascinating. And I think one of the things I think that was really interesting was, at the time, there was genuine, we were being fairly carefully watched, I think, and the film itself, you know, by the British establishment, and because it was the first time that a story, like a really independent story, had been told about an incident, you know, like arising from our troubled sort of modern history. And so there was great interest in it, and great scrutiny and observation of it. But it was absolutely... It was just one of the most amazing experiences of my life. It was absolutely brilliant working with people like Daniel Day-Lewis.
But to be involved in handing the book to somebody, and then to see it come to fruition, and then to witness the success of the film once it was out.
Oh, I mean, it was absolutely fantastic. And, in part of the research, I got to sort of, you know, look back over transcripts of the original interviews that the four did when they were first lifted. And, you know, even reading those, I was going, how did anybody think these guys did it? So to see the germ of the film in Jim Sheridan's mind, and then it turned into the film, and then it ended up in Hollywood and was nominated for several Oscars, which I got to go to, which was very nice.
And you would also recommend Michael Collins, even though you weren't involved in that, despite me trying to foist that on you.
Even though it wasn't, I'd love to have been, because it was an absolutely great film. And again, to see such an iconic Irish figure get the sort of Hollywood treatment. A lot of people argued about the, you know, there were various historic liberties taken in it. But you know what? It was still such a great film, and it still stands up to a watch every now and then with a big bucket of popcorn.
Okay, now, Johnny, for you, a movie that stands out is Wag the Dog. Maybe we'll take a listen to a clip from Wag the Dog, and then we'll have a chat about it.
There's a crisis in the White House.
What's the crisis?
And the president's top advisors have been called together.
Oh, jeez.
The sexual misconduct occurred inside the Oval Office. With the election only days away, how much will this scandal affect the outcome?
The president spent the weekend pressing the flash. He wasn't campaigning, he was dating, actually.
Now, Washington's top spin doctor.
We can distract the press for 11 days till the election. I think we got a chance.
Has an idea.
We can't afford a war.
We're gonna have the appearance of a war.
But he can't pull it off without Hollywood's top producer.
Do I know you?
We have some mutual friends in Washington.
Why come to me?
We want you to produce.
You want me to produce your war?
Not a war, it's a pageant. We need a theme, a song, some visuals. We need, you know, it's a pageant.
The president's gonna go to war with Albania in about 30 minutes.
Albania's hard to rhyme.
Albania, Albania.
That rhymes.
That's Wag the Dog, Johnny. Why should we watch this one?
Yeah, I think it's at the time it was considered an extreme version of maybe what goes on in the back rooms of politics, but maybe not so extreme anymore considering some of the things we know. But it is fascinating as a film. It's very entertaining, great watch, but it's also, I mean, anybody who has been involved in backroom politics knows this, and it's a great set of, you know, look, they've got to come up with an idea to get the president out of this difficulty. They create this image of a war, but it's a valuable lesson too in how, especially in politics, you never have just one good idea. One good idea has to be followed by about 10 other good ideas because you keep getting into another mess. And as they create this fake war to divert attention, they keep having to go one step further. They have to find a soldier who's behind the lines. Then that soldier, when they get him and they manage to fly him back, he's not exactly what they wanted. You end up with Willie Nelson writing songs about it, the whole country taken in by this, and you know, these guys in the background just trying to get away with it. Mm-hmm. And there is a few hairy moments for them in it as you look at it. And you think, I suppose the deeper lesson for political nerds in it is that, you know, yeah, you know, it's one thing after another, one problem after another. And how do you find solutions to each problem as you go?
Donny Fallon and Lise Hand from Today with Claire Byrne. Now it's the collective sigh of relief. That's what it feels like. Now that women are sharing their sadnesses and struggles with the menopause, on the live line, Liz, who is originally from Dublin but now lives in Sydney, Australia.
Look, when I reached 45, all of a sudden I got really severe periods. And I'm working as a teacher here in Sydney in like a Caitlin College,
okay,
equivalent to the old Catlett Brewery.
Yeah.
And really impacted on my life. I'd have to put a towel in the car in my driver's seat. Mm-hmm. When I get to work, I'd have to change and whatever. And then in the middle of class, I'd have to change. And I just put up with it. I just thought that was life. However, I was due for a GP examination.
Okay.
And went to my GP for a general examination and general blood test. Got a phone call from my GP a couple of days later and says, "You're severely anemic.
Mm-hmm.
You need to come and see me." And I says, "What?" And she's here, severely anemic. So I went in, never mentioned the periods really, just said, she says, "Well, we have to go and send you for tests and whatever, and all sorts of tests on the womb, and there was no bleeds and all." And then she came back and she says, "You're perimenopausal." And I said, "What's that?"
Yeah.
And she says, "You don't know." And I says, "No." And my GP is lovely here. She's from England. She's from Manchester. And she explained the whole and I felt like such a gobshite.
Right.
Pure, absolute gobshite. What's perimenopausal? What's this? What's that?
Yeah.
And I thought I'd educate myself on lots of things, but I didn't know anything. And she gave me the Mirena. And she says, "You have to go on that." And I said, no, I don't want that. I don't want anything. Why would I want this? And she says, "No, it'll make a difference to your life." Well, the difference. And I've now started other symptoms and stuff, but I know the path I'm ahead now.
Okay.
And why was I listening to your show? Because I don't sleep at night.
Yeah.
And I am listening to all sorts of podcasts and stuff whatever. And that's how, so.
And the bleeding that you described, Liz, you had to put the towel, you put a towel on your car seat before you got in, you'd wear tracksuit bottoms, you'd have to, but you're standing in front of a class, are you? For an hour at a time.
Yeah, and then I'd have to go, every half an hour. I ruined two mattresses. We had to replace air mattresses twice.
Wow.
And that was with pads and everything, And in front of students, and in terms of the workplace, I never really brought it up. I think because I didn't know what was happening, to be honest. I was so ignorant. And I look back now and I go, oh, my God. And we're quite lucky here in Australia in terms of workplace legislation, in terms of health and safety and all that. And I'm sure if I was to bring it up. But in saying that, I've never heard of anyone saying, "I'm off sick because of menopause."
Yeah.
Well, that's Liz in Sydney there. Then Anne called. She works for an airline and has a very early menopause.
Early menopause, 39. I was expecting it. I had my period, my first period at 8 years of age. I was told I would hit menopause early. You didn't know what it was at the time.
Yeah.
Presumed menopause meant end of period, full stop. By God, how wrong I was. Hot flushes, the mood swings, just like every other lovely lady that you've been speaking to over the last week.
Yeah.
anxiety, itchy skin, brain fog, restless leg syndrome, all of them. The one, I suppose, that would affect me most at work was the old hot flushes.
Yeah,
I was the one going to work in me shirt with the coat over my arm in snow on the ground, you know.
And what would you do on a long flight when you're working?
Yeah, I had to bring, I'd always had to bring change of shirt, change of work scarf, change of tights, several pairs of clean underpants in the suitcase, and change several times on the long flights because my blouse would be literally drenched.
Wow.
And used to hate having to reach up to the overhead lockers or do the safety demonstration because I knew that my underarms were drenched. But you, like every other woman in this country, you put up and you shut up.
And did you raise it in the workplace? Was there any understanding?
No. I can imagine my airline is very good. And if I did bring it up, I'm sure it would have been addressed. But you didn't feel that. You felt nearly like, as I said, a lot, you shut up and put up. Yeah. And menopause was kind of seen as a natural phase of a woman's life. And that we should be well able to cope with that sort of.
And there was a silence around it. And it's a job of employers to lead. That's why it's a job of bosses to lead. So maybe the lead should be coming from them. But you list all this, hot flushes, tinnitus is coming up a lot as well. Which what you hear about it, it's awful. It's awful. And what is the tinnitus gone?
Yeah, the gas thing about all of this, Joe, is it's such a simple answer to it.
Yeah.
All the symptoms, where I was treating them individually, I was putting, say, magnesium oil for the restless leg syndrome. I was taking antihistamines for the itchy skin, et cetera, et cetera. And then something as simple as a couple of pumps of estrogel once a day in the morning. It was like I was a new woman.
And some women shared their stories via voice note.
I'm a 42-year-old mother of three, and I suffered gynecological issues in my early 30s and was put into an induced menopause for 6 or 8 months to help with endometriosis. That was fine. It resolved my issues. But now over the last couple of years, I've started getting hot flushes, chronic fatigue, joint pains. I've been diagnosed with an autoimmune condition and fibromyalgia. No libido. It's just a horrible, horrible thing. I never thought at 42 that I would be experiencing these symptoms. I feel sorry for all the other women that go through this and for all the husbands that have to deal with wives when they're going through this.
Hi, Joe. I'm in year 12 of the menopause. Usual, same as the other callers. The hot flushes, the changing of the bed sheet several times a night, the tiredness, the weight gain, the dryness. But the thing I found the most disturbing was the anger. Going into a corner press and throwing everything on the floor for absolutely no reason, thinking that you were going to do damage to your children. It's all very disconcerting, but it is part of it.
Hi, Joe. I have a very different perspective on the menopause. I'm 54 and I couldn't get HRT. This was due to the fact that my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was only 50, due to her hormonal changes. Unfortunately, she passed away 2 years ago. I feel quite lucky. Unlike other callers, I have not had hot flushes. I do, however, find myself reliant on alcohol. When I look back, it definitely happened since I was in the menopause, particularly the perimenopause, which began when I was probably 43.
Just some of the voices from the live line. And in the morning, before talking about the Civil War and other stories, it was a literal trip down memory lane and flights of stairs when Ryan Tuberty was chatting to Miles Duncan.
Good morning, Mr. Tuberty. I remember doing horrible things to you in the 1990s. I hope it's forgiven. You're not going to give me a hard time.
You're referring to, I suspect, where you made me go in at the deep end to become a stand-up comedian, an auctioneer, a hairdresser, an opera singer, and...
Stuntman. Don't forget the stuntman.
Stuntman. Do you remember that lovely man, Martin Grace from Kilkenny, threw me down the steps of the radio centre and you...
And made you put your fist through a window and I think
and
set
me
you
on fire. Exactly. Yeah. And you were there saying, can I have a go?
Oh, I was there every bit of the way and I watched your discomfort and thoroughly enjoyed it, which is why I have great fear
today.
About what you're going to do to me today.
You should. And also that when you insisted on having a go at throwing me down the steps, putting me on fire and putting me through a window, I thought, they've stopped recording this. You know, it was just your anger got the better of you. Miles, you're back with this book, Four Killings: Land, Hunger, Murder, and Family in the Irish Revolution. Why I love this book is because, talking to you this morning, there are very few people listening, Miles, as you well know, who don't have a great grandfather or an actual grandfather or somebody in their family who didn't have some connection with either the War of Independence or, broadly speaking, the land. And when we think about this week, Miles, about property and how housing is still the big issue in 2021. If you could imagine 100 years ago, go back to the agrarian struggle before that again, back to the famine before that again. This country, the land, every blade of grass and stone extracted from the soil, it's visceral, isn't it?
Absolutely visceral. And I mean, you talk about closeness of connections. One of the people who was incredibly helpful with me or for me on this book was my cousin Joe McKenna. Mm. One of those weird, another of those weird Irish anomalies. Joe is about 5 years younger than me, but he's my mother's generation. So there are many, many references in the book to his father, John McKenna. So that's how close, in many cases, we still are to the war. Even though it's 100 years ago, we're still that close. But as far as the land is concerned, because what I think what you're getting at here is this book is about the War of Independence.
Yes.
And it's about my extended family and murder and killing and executions in the War of Independence. But it starts in Arizona, and it starts with a land dispute involving another member of the family in Arizona who would not have been there in the first place had it not been for the land situation in the 1880s and 1890s in Ireland. And then that's the first killing. And then the second killing is of his nephew, Mark Clinton, the man in Arizona is Jack Clinton. Mark Clinton is then murdered. He's an IRA volunteer and he's killed in May 1920, but not by the RIC, not by the Black and Tans, not by the dreaded Oxies, but by local people who are seizing land. And this is something that went on during the War of Independence, before it and after it, in actual fact, particularly during the Civil War, but had been going on for the better part of 20 years.
And Ryan pointed out the importance of land ownership in these conflicts.
Even throughout the book, Land League, Land War, Land Grabbers, land. It's this central thread running through the whole story.
And don't forget, 1906 to 1909, a little war that people often ignore, the Ranch Wars. Because what was happening was the landlords weren't all gone. I mean, there were still some of them left. There were still some of them hanging on. Mm. They didn't hang on for much longer after the Free State was set up. But they had basically been replaced. They had been replaced by a fairly rich landowning Catholic middle class. And these, by and large, were what they called the graziers or the ranchers. And this was a period where you had a movement. And this had been going on for the better part of 50 years, but it's accentuated at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm. A movement from tillage to pasture as population declined and as there were fewer people and a little bit more land became available. What you got was this kind of rural agricultural middle class buying up land, and instead of planting crops, they were putting cattle and they were putting sheep onto this land, and then these were being exported to markets in Britain. And that meant that you had an underclass of small farmers and landless labourers who had no chance whatever of acquiring land of their own and acquiring their own 20 acres or whatever the minimum was to keep themselves going. And there were, you read diatribes being written about this waste of land and particularly in the part of the country where I live, which is County Meath, this wastage of land, all this land and all you've got, it's completely devastated because it's just got cattle on it. It's got grass and cattle. No crops are growing. You know, I mean, it sounds a little bit strange and a bit anomalous to us nowadays to some extent, because we really are, you know, we're very much into our pasture rather than our tillage. But that was not the case at the beginning of the 20th century.
Of course, you know, if you again, rhyming history with what you're saying, no part of society, there is a part of society who had no chance whatever, to use your own words, to own a house, to own property. It's all back to this.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, again, everyone, well, most people in Ireland have we call it in our family, there's always an archivist within the family. It's not me, funny enough, in my family, it's my brother, one of my brothers, but who have a good brain for figures and stories and, you know, the way history gets muddled in the passing of time, where you go, do you remember that time you did that? You go, he didn't do it, she did it. You go, oh, right, okay. So this brings us to your maternal grandmother, who played such a central part of it. And in fact, as I was reading about her, Mary Teresa McKenna, or May McKenna, she was probably, you know, her interest in life. I could see her in another world as a presenter of 5-7 Live, you know, once upon a time, as it was before Drive Time and so on. You know what I mean? She swallowed the papers, even the sports section. She was definitely, the gene traveled well, Miles.
Well, I mean, she was the reason I ended up as presenter of 5-7 Live and quite a few other things, there's no doubt about it, because she was a huge influence on me, because she spent a lot of time. She had plenty of time to spend, and she had this kind of mophead young grandson, and she would spend quite a bit of time, but she'd spend a month in the summertime, and then she'd spend, you know, a couple of weeks at other times of the year, and we'd go visit her, and she would babysit me a lot. She would look after me when my mother or father were doing stuff, and there were lots of walks in and around the area of the Park Hotel in Virginia, which was, I think, once a Lord Hedford's hunting lodge, and it's now a hotel. But and she would tell me stories, and she would tell me stories about, and she would talk to me about things, and she would get me interested. She got me interested in, you know, I was a nerd. I was a nerd long before you were a nerd. you know, she got me interested in politics when I was, God help us, about 9 or 10 years old.
Yes.
And you know, she, I remember as a very small kid, one of my earliest memories as a very small kid is of being woken up by my grandmother to go and witness the inauguration of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, for example.
Right.
That's the kind of level that we're dealing with here.
Yes.
And she was a repository, there's no doubt about it. She had great stories.
So she had stories, but she also had secrets.
One of the things in the introduction to the book, I talk about my relationship with my grandmother.
Mm.
And she had no problem telling me stories of being rousted out by the Black and Tans in, you know, 1920, 1921, and worried about the house being burnt to the ground because that had happened to other people and all this kind of stuff. And I, of course, I swallowed this, and I developed what a lot of people do at that age, a visceral hatred of our neighbours, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Now, I've managed to get over that, thankfully.
Yes.
Not totally. You know, I still, you know, in a penalty shootout between England and Germany, I know who I support. Anyway, so, you know, I was getting all this on her knee almost. And I swallowed it, and I thought, this is fascinating stuff. My God, those Black and Tans were horrible, and those people she calls the Ogsies, whatever that means, they were horrible as well. And then when I got older and I got into learning history and studying history, I began to doubt. I kind of thought, oh, for God's sake, why would the Black and Tans be interested in my genteel grandmother? I knew that she had a brother, Justin McKenna, from Kells, or lived in Kells, from Mullagh originally, but lived in Kells, who was a TD. He was in the second Dáil. He voted on the treaty. He voted in favour of the treaty. That everybody knew, because my mother was, you know, was very happy to talk about him. My grandmother was always very happy to talk about him. And I knew my two granduncles, her other brothers, Ralph McKenna and John McKenna, both from Mullagh. But what she never told me was that they had been in the IRA. And this I had to discover for myself. Another cousin, Erna McKenna, is a solicitor in London. She told me about the involvement of three of my grandmother's brothers, T.P., Rafe and John McKenna, in the IRA. And so I just got interested in it. And then when the pensions collections, when they got up to the period of the War of Independence, the first draft of pensions collections that were put online, our pensions files that were put online was from 1916. And then the next draft was from the War of Independence. So I just, you know, I could check out and see if any of them are up there. And one of the brothers, T.P. McKenna, the youngest, who died tragically of TB in Argentina at the age of 26, his was up there. And I went through it. And that's when I had this light bulb moment where I came across a line in his pension file in which it was stated that he had, quote-unquote, executed an informer in Carlinstown. And that started me off.
Well, it would, wouldn't it? Miles Duncan's book is called Four Killings and is out now. He was talking to Ryan Tuberty in the morning. And on Today with Claire Byrne, reporter Brian O'Connell was posing the question, would you give a stranger a lift? We're talking hitchhiking in the COVID era.
Brian, I asked this question this morning when the programme started at 10. I think we got one message from one person who continues to pick up hitchhikers, because I reckon that hitchhiking is just gone.
It was in decline, no doubt about it. I mean, I feel like this is an ambush. Should I just go home now? It's my first time here in a year. And this is
I can't believe you still, like, would you still hitchhike?
I wouldn't hitchhike, no, but I mean, I would have seen people on occasion over pre-COVID.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in tourist areas. I mean, I was a prolific hitchhiker in my teens and early 20s. Like, I grew up a couple of miles outside of Ennis, and we would have hitched into town on a Friday night or a Saturday afternoon. So that was really normal. And then when it came to coming to college in Cork, like, most Fridays I would have hitched home, because you'd have spent the bus money. I mean, that was the reality. Socialising was more important. So it was a really different world, though. For example, when I got out to the Old Mallow Road on a Friday, there was maybe 10 or 15 people ahead of me.
Right.
So you might have to walk out a couple of miles to hitch.
to beat the crowd.
To beat the crowd. There was a whole etiquette to it. And I think once I got stuck outside Charleville in the lashing rain for 2 or 3 hours, and that was really it. I had a pretty good hitchhiking career. The last time actually I hitchhiked was for Ryan Tuberty, did it on the radio, and I hitched from Bantry to Bundoran to see could I get there before the bus, and I did. Probably because I was on radio telling people I was hitchhiking.
Yeah, exactly.
So I suppose as a former hitchhiker, you know, if I do see someone on the road, I'd often stop. But for the last year and a half, of course, I haven't seen any hitchhikers for obvious COVID-related reasons. But, I mean, obviously, if we can't have our extended family in a car, we're not going to invite a stranger in and pick them up on the side of the road. But hitchhiking, yeah, absolutely. It had been in decline for years.
Yeah, I think so. And will we go over the reasons why it was in decline?
Well, I think people had become a lot more safety conscious. There was a time in the 90s, for example, I would have often got lifts off truck drivers heading for Shannon. But because of insurance issues then over the years, truck drivers wouldn't stop anymore. So that was one group of people who wouldn't pick you up. You can't hitch on motorways, for example. The public road transport infrastructure is much better now. And it's more cheaper, I think, to get around on public transport than it would have been back in the 90s. But there is still a community, I think, who love the adventure of hitchhiking. Maybe heading off to Europe, for example, all you have is a card and you write your sign when you get to each town. So there's a real freedom to hitchhiking. And we're going to hear from...
Freedom of my life. You're
totally
skeptical.
Sorry,
I'm obviously too old, because I do admit that I did hitchhike probably when in my college days. But just even the thoughts of it now...
That's about the mid-80s, was it?
Yeah, a long time ago. But if my child, they're not of an age now, but, you know, if they were in their teens and they told me they were going to hitchhike, you'd be the same yourself.
I'd be horrified. I mean, it feels like a completely different world, obviously. We will hear from an Irish folk legend shortly on the glory days of hitchhiking. But one man who knows a lot about it, Claire, is Rory McKiernan. He's an author, he's a campaigner, he's a podcast host. He hitched around Ireland and he wrote a book about it, Hitching for Hope. So I had a chat with Rory McKiernan just about his experiences. And he told me, hitchhiking growing up in County Cavan.
Hitchhiking was a normal part of life for me. You know, you'd be hitchhiking to matches and training and maybe home from school as well. I'd hitchhike regularly home from school. Talk about hitchhiking now as some kind of strange experience, but it was a very, very normal, regular part of life. Can, as you get older, certainly you get a bit more rigid and maybe a little bit more conservative. And I like that idea of just being out and about, as you do in your own job, out and about meeting people and hearing from people. And I think it's really important. And
so you went back hitchhiking for a book.
What I really went looking for was connection for hope in the post-Celtic Tiger Ireland, where I felt that we'd lost something of ourselves. I suppose just this call to adventure came, and the idea of hitchhiking just at that point seemed a bit mad, to be honest. And it just ended up being this remarkable life-changing experience that led me to writing a book. And it was a book, it's a book ultimately about kindness, about connection.
So Brian also spoke to a folk legend about the heyday of hitchhiking.
So obviously, that's Stockton Swing with their classic song, A Beautiful Affair. And I guess when you think back to the 70s and 80s, to places like Doolin, which inspired that song, and the folk scene then, hitching a lift was really part and parcel of getting to gigs and going on adventures, maybe getting to work. So the Stockton Swing lead singer is Clareman Mike Hanrahan, and Mike talked to me about his hitchhiking heyday.
Well, it would have started when I was a young kid at school. Whenever we travelled anywhere, we hitchhiked. But my real career started when I left school and I discovered a place called Doolin. I worked in Shannon Airport, so I had no car. I couldn't drive. So the only way to travel was try and scoff a lift up to Doolin on the Fridays, because we played music there. The right thing to do would come home on Sunday and be ready for the bus on Monday morning. But that rarely happens. So you'd find yourself getting up at the crack of dawn on Monday morning, and you might get a lift into Ennisdiamond or something, and then you'd wiggle your way down to Ennis, try and catch the bus when you get to Ennis. So that was a regular feature. And of course, Dublin, I mean, we hitched to Dublin and back so many times, and it was different times. The roads were different, but yeah, but they were good crack days, because you'd meet all sorts of characters, and it'd take you hours. Like it could take you a full day to get to Dublin. But I mean, it was our only mode of transport, really, Brian. That's how we could travel around. The queuing system was very important, you know, because you'd have to try and get to the far end of the queue without being spotted.
It's incredible to think of it now, isn't it, Mike, given COVID and given social distancing, that you would put your hand out and a stranger would stop and you'd both sit 2 feet apart from each other.
Oh yeah, that will never happen. I can't see it ever happening again either, really. And of course, it did change, Brian, because I guess people's trust was questioned. And as a driver, I'd be very wary of myself to pick up anybody. And maybe that's wrong with my own history of hitching, but that's how it is.
Brian O'Connell from Today with Claire Byrne. And back to those menopause stories from the live line. And Julie called Jo about being post-menopause and her ongoing symptoms.
I was diagnosed at age 38 with breast cancer. So I was I had underwent a mastectomy with chemotherapy and radiotherapy.
Okay.
And I was plunged into a very early menopause.
Yeah.
I went through about 15 really bad years. I would say 20 years later, thankfully, I'm cancer-recovered, cancer-free, but I'm still going through symptoms.
Yeah.
I couldn't have HRT because I was estrogen receptive, and I would begged for anything at the time. I mean, obviously, I never, I was so glad to be alive, but everything seemed to have something in it that I just couldn't have. Doctor said, oh, it'll pass, you know, in a few years it'll be gone. But like I said, here I am, you know, 20 years later, and listening, I've heard of women in their 70s, 80s, 90s who still get these hot flushes. For me, it's definitely the hot flushes.
Yeah.
I mean, I had the really bad night sweats and everything, but the hot flushes, I can just say, I felt like, and still do, feel like jumping out of my skin. You just want to jump into a bucket of ice.
Yeah.
Like, it's not, you know, people would say, oh, sure, that's nothing. It's not nothing. I got no sleep. It was like I had this some kind of a timer going off. It was 20 minutes. I would be fast asleep, and then 20 minutes later, I'm wide awake and just thrashing off the bed clothes,
fire,
everything off. On fire. And of course, hubby, just like, he has to move. Like, I'm thrashing about the bed. I need the cold spot. It's just a nightmare. I'm like, nobody could possibly sleep with me. And with the hot flush then comes an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
And I was saying to your researcher there that, you know, my workplace would be very understanding, but when you're in an office with mixed people, you just don't talk about it unless you're with a group of women who are going through it, and that wasn't the case. But I literally clammed up for about 2 or 3 years, because I found that if I was speaking to a group of people and I got a flush, now I suppose a flush is probably invisible. I don't think people really see it, but you're so on fire that you imagine you're burning red. So the flush turned into a full-blown blush because I was so embarrassed. So then I just, every time I went to speak, I said, oh no, I'm going to get a flush. Or if I did get a flush, oh no, it would turn into a blush. So I literally stopped. I was terrified to open my mouth in a group of people for a few years.
So that sends you further away even from discourse and engagement with your colleagues?
Absolutely. You know, it was just a very quiet time. I just became highly sensitive and embarrassed.
But Julie, 15 years so far.
It's actually 18 years now.
Of your life.
And as I said, and I just don't think it's going to go away.
Then Deirdre called from New York.
So I just retired from 20 years being on the police department, and listening to your show has clarified my life for the past couple of years. I am 57, and I became a police officer at 35. Okay. I would say I started menopause at 50.
Yeah.
I had a tremendous amount of the symptoms. I never got one hot flush, as you say. We call it hot flashes. I was chronically hot for 2 years.
Yeah.
Wintertime, I'd be out on patrol, no jacket, no coat. But one of my main issues where I had was when I needed to get to a public, I was a foot post, so I was walking or in a car. And if I needed to get to a bathroom, I had to find a bathroom that could be locked, a complete door from head to toe, not a door with a latch and you can put your arm over, because I had to carry a gun belt and take that off, and it weighed 20 pounds. Sometimes I had to carry that around my neck so that I know somebody couldn't grab it from over the other side of the door, change my pad, try to keep my hands clean, and... Put it all back on again. The brain fog lately has gotten terrible. Like I said, I never got a hot flash or a night sweat, but chronically hot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I retired because all that stress is gone now. Having to find the toilet, having to carry pads on a uniform that you have no extra pockets, having to explain to a partner sometimes, oh, I got to pop into the bathroom here. What's wrong with you? Why are you always going to the bathroom? Plus heavy menstruation.
Yeah.
But just dealt with it. You know, like the young lady was saying about in the car, she stood up.
Yeah, Liz.
I remember having two pads and a tampon on just so I wouldn't go through my uniform.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm glad I've been listening.
And Deirdre, did you retire because of the menopause symptoms?
I won't say I retired because of that. I had my 20 years in and I was allowed to retire.
Okay.
Yeah, but it would made it easier not to have to worry about anything like that. Seriously, I remember having my period and saying, look, I don't have to find a safe toilet to go to.
Yeah.
I'm okay, you know. It was difficult. It was very difficult. Unless you're a woman, you wouldn't understand it, you know.
Yeah. And in terms of... Are you on medication at the moment? Have you managed to get HRT or about HRT?
Nothing. I'm heading on Tuesday to see my gynecologist to talk about it because I, like everybody else, thought it caused cancer and never even questioned about it. I literally have been putting up with the symptoms. I found CBD since I retired. I'm so comfortable to take that. I would have loved to have taken it as a police officer, but I was afraid it would cause a positive test in my urine. We're random drug tested. And that has helped me an awful lot with anxiety and anger.
Okay.
That's Deirdre on the live line with Joe Duffy. And on the Ray Darcy Show, sculptor Adrian Hart was explaining his creation, the Puka of Ennisdiman.
Well, yeah, it's a fella with a horse's head, basically.
Right.
And he's started dancing a little jig. He's got trousers that are worse for wear, a little ragged. He's got feet that are quite big, basketballer size, and he's got a bit of a mischievous pose to him.
Yeah, and so the horse's head is disproportionately large for the body. Is that fair enough to say?
Oh, it's very fair to say. It's bigger than a horse, much bigger.
Yeah.
Like he himself is a 2 metre tall statue and eventually will be a 2 metre tall bronze statue.
Okay. And then is that his tail?
Yeah. The tail is sort of there for structural reasons. I mean, he has a tail because he's a puka and you have to have a tail. But it's helping him stand up.
Aha, yes, yes. So, right. Now, let's talk about the process first. So somebody decided that they needed a piece of art, a sculpture in the middle of Ennis Diamond, and they put it out to tender. Mm. And that happens regularly, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, obviously not as often as I'd like, but it's there'd be, I don't know, a dozen or more would come up every year around the country. Like, for instance, the one in Dunleary last year, that was a big one. But the one in, and then Dublin City has done a bunch of them recently. But the one in Ennis Diamond, the budget would have been on the smaller end of things. But
What's the smaller end of things?
I mean, 30,000. So
okay.
The higher end would be 80s and keep going up. But it's... The upside of that was there was a bit of freedom with the brief. Like some sculpture proposals, they'd be very specific in that. Like, for example, the Dunleary one was, they were asking for a 8-foot statue of Roger Casement in a realistic style in bronze.
Okay, so that's quite specific.
That's cut and dry.
Yes.
You know,
so the people in Ennis Diamond were more open ended in their brief. So what was it exactly?
Well, it was they were inviting the artists of all sorts to propose something that would reflect the heritage of Ennis Diamond, and with, like, they mentioned the horse fair that was a big thing in Ennis Diamond's past.
Right.
And they said also that the master plan behind this is that Ennis Diamond is being done up, like, at the moment with lots of money being spent, like, to work out the traffic, because it was a bit of a traffic nightmare in recent years. And they basically want it to be a place that tourists stop at rather than a place they you know, go out of their way to avoid.
Adrian Hart from The Ray Darcy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, 80% of adults in Ireland use it, but there are big changes on the way for WhatsApp.
Now, could we all be kicked off WhatsApp unless we agree to a controversial new privacy policy update that lets it connect to Facebook businesses? From this Saturday, your WhatsApp will tell you that unless you agree to these changes, you lose your access to your chat list, and eventually you lose access to messages and calls. For more on this, I'm joined by technology editor with the Irish and Sunday Independent, Adrian Weck. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Claire.
So tell me what's happening here. What's Facebook trying to do here?
It wants to update its WhatsApp privacy policy, so to let businesses on Facebook add a WhatsApp button on their page so that if you tap that, you can connect to them and they can connect to you, and you can connect between the two platforms. Now, there are very strict data sharing rules in Europe against Facebook being allowed to start sharing information and account data between those two services. Don't forget, Facebook owns WhatsApp, mm-hmm. and regulators here are very worried that WhatsApp, which is a free messaging service, by far the most used text messaging service in Ireland, 80% of Irish adults use it, 3/4 of them use it every day. Regulators here don't want a scenario where Facebook starts hoovering up your WhatsApp information, you start seeing ads all over the place. But what they're actually doing, what the actual update is a button on Facebook that would be a direct connection between you on WhatsApp into that Facebook business.
So they're trying to monetize WhatsApp.
Yeah, WhatsApp is free. They spent $20 billion buying it a few years back. They've never had a way of making money out of it. They're chomping at the bit to try and somehow get ad revenue from so many people who use WhatsApp. They haven't figured out a way to do it. In Europe, the regulators, mainly the regulator here, Data Protection Commissioner, won't let them do it unless they come up with a really good reason why they should do it. And this is one way that they're kind of trying to get around it.
Adrian Weckler from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.